To start the chain reaction, all we need is one neutron. We have inherited a wealth of knowledge from the great thinkers of the past. The atomic reactor, then, gives us a chance to make the atomic genie our friend. I think you can see what is going to happen. Watch.
Contrary to popular belief, I am not dead, and I apologize that it's taken me so long to get another one of these out. Regardless, I am happy to bring you episode 12 of Radio Nuclear. My name is Doug Hartmeyer, and the reason for my long, way too long absence was because I started a new job. That's right, I moved from Columbus down to DC, working in the swamp, not in policy, but rather with NPR Associates in Alexandria, Virginia. I can truly say that working full-time truly makes you appreciate the time when you are a student when you really don't have any responsibilities. I know that may not be popular with some of you. Grad students, yes, you do have responsibilities, but just wait till you start working full-time. With that, though, I mean, I've been learning a ton of new things about nuclear industry and just engineering as a whole and actually getting to apply the things that you learn in school in the real life and for real life applications is such a great opportunity. And I couldn't be more thankful that, first of all, I find myself gainfully employed. And second of all, have the opportunity to learn from so many talented and interesting individuals, some of which I'm sure will be appearing on the show here in the near future. Now, just because I'm working full-time doesn't mean that I've forgotten about Radio Nuclear and my lovely fans, however. Got a lot of exciting things behind the scenes that should hopefully help make these more regular. Keep posted on that, but just rest assured, haven't forgot about you, and I do feel guilty about not getting these out more regularly. So, that being said, enough of this jibber-jabber, let's move right into the news. Duke Energy is beginning to restart Unit 1 in the wake of Hurricane Florence of its Brunswick nuclear power plant. This story titled, Duke Energy Nuke Plant Shut Down for Florence Ramps Towards Full Power. It was written by John Downey for bizjournals.com, and he is also a senior staff writer at the Charlotte Business Journal. The story was published on September 24th of 2018. Now, obviously a lot of news has happened in my absence, but I wanted to get into some recurring theme. It always pops up around hurricane season. And in fact, I've talked about in previous episodes about how everyone works themselves up into an absolute tizzy whenever there's a hurricane approaching and nuclear power plants happen to be in the path of it. It's always a news ticker item in any news outlet talking about the nuclear power plants that are in the path of these storms. And what happens, might you ask? Not a thing. Ever. Nothing ever happens to these plants. These plants are rock solid. But you guys know the news these days. They can't let a good fake story get away. But now that the storm is in the rear view and, you know, my heart goes out to anyone that lost any possessions, family members, and all that, these plants are still fine. And in fact, Brunswick, which was the only plant that wasn't in refueling in the eye of this storm, is beginning to near full capacity again. So this comes from the article, but according to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Brunswick Unit 1 was operating at 68% capacity on Monday morning, and Unit 2, which Duke restarted earlier, is now operating at around 90% capacity. Each unit is about 930 megawatts of capacity. So for those who don't know, it does take a little while to kind of ramp up the reactor power that consistently can deliver in the wake of a natural disaster and provide the needed electricity that first responders need to help save lives and rebuild communities. And that's nuclear energy. And we see it time and time again. And wouldn't it be so nice if these nuclear plants got that recognition before the storm hit? The recognition that they can deliver after the storm. But instead, that fact kind of goes by the wayside and is quickly forgotten by the time that the next storm spins up in the Atlantic. In other news, Oyster Creek has shut down. It's very unfortunate. The story I'll be reading from comes from the New Jersey Real-Time News, titled Somber Day as Nation's Oldest Nuclear Power Plant Closes. What's Next? Posted on September 18th of 2018, written by Bill Gallo Jr. So for those of you who didn't know, Oyster Creek is, or was, America's oldest nuclear generating station. It came online on December 23rd of 1969. So it's been providing carbon-free power for nearly five decades. That's insane. So why did the plant shut down? This comes to us from the article. But Exelon, the plant's owner, had come to an agreement with New Jersey, saying it would shut the plant down in 2019 if it could be allowed to not build cooling towers on the plant site. Environmentalists had argued that the drawing of water from Oyster Creek to cool the nuclear plant was impacting the environment there and the adjacent Barnegat Bay. I hope I'm saying that right. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission had originally given Oyster Creek a license extension, which would have allowed it to remain operating through 2029. Think of that. The plant could have been running for 60 years. Amazing. Earlier this year, Exelon surprised many with the announcement that it would shut the plant by the end of 2018. The date was moved up until Monday. The nuclear industry is also facing competition from cheap natural gas, which is being used to fuel electric generators. Price drop in gas has been a key factor in decisions at other nuclear plant operators to either close the reactors or nix plans to build new nuclear plants altogether. The loss of electricity produced by Oyster Creek will have no impact on New Jersey power customers, the New Jersey Board of Public Utilities say. Which, hopefully, many of you after listening to this program have realized once you hear someone say that, you know it's not true. So what's going on with the future of the plant then? So Holtec is actually buying it for the decommissioning job. But what I think is really nice, and I got to give props to the author of this article, Bill Gallo, is that he broke down Oyster Creek's impact by the numbers. So let's go over some of those real quick. $3.43 billion, with a B, in economic impact, including wages, taxes, and local purchasing. 600,000 homes and businesses powered each year by one nuclear plant. $87 million, the approximate annual payroll to all of its employees. And this is a really cool statistic. $20 million, the amount Oyster Creek and employees have donated to local nonprofit organizations since 1969. I don't know if that number is adjusted for inflation, but that's pretty remarkable. $143 million, the number of metric tons of carbon Oyster Creek has offset in its lifetime. And lastly, $257 million, the estimated number of hours employees worked, safely and with excellence. That's the other thing you need to consider when talking about nuclear too, I think, is that the scale of everything is absolutely massive. Every number that I read you just about had to deal with either millions or billions in terms of dollars or tons of carbon removed or hours worked without incident for any of the employees. And you can't do better than that anywhere in this energy industry. And again, props to the author. He's trying to show both sides here, but he also included, is this a victory for environmentalists? And so here's some excerpts from local environmental groups. Again, coming to us from the article, environmentalists hailed the shutdown of Oyster Creek as a victory. This is a historic day for New Jersey because Oyster Creek is finally closing. This was the oldest nuclear plant in the country and a disaster waiting to happen, said Jeff Tittle, director of the New Jersey Sierra Club. By closing early, it will help protect both the environment and public safety. We've been fighting this plant for more than 15 years, and this closure is long overdue. This is an important day for our state and for moving forward with renewable energy. The decommissioning and dismantling of this plant should be done as soon as possible. The plant itself is falling apart and located on a site vulnerable to sea level rise. All right, come on, Doug. Be objective here. At least try. The faster you can decommission and clean it up, the safer we will be, and the sooner we can use the site for a different purpose. It's important that the plant is finally closing, but we need to be sure that it is done right. I've read a lot of jargon like this, but I don't know if I've ever read one that was so self-unaware. I mean, seriously, you're saying that the plant is dangerous because it's in a location that is susceptible to sea level rise, but yet you're actively fighting against our greatest asset at preventing that very atrocity. I don't understand the logic ever with this. Clean energy is good, Carbon-free energy is good, but not that kind of carbon-free energy. We want this very specific kind. We're for it until we're against it. I give it a couple more years before this type of environmentalist, the one that doesn't listen to fact or reason, the non-eco-modernist, is going to flip on solar and wind. Just a matter of time. They're not consistent with what they support. Maybe then people will stop taking them seriously. But secondly, the thing that I hate, and you see this with arguments all the time, not just when talking about nuclear stuff, but we'll use this as an example, is when someone doesn't have any facts, they go right to your emotions. So we talked about it before on this program, but you have that middle third that may not have a hard and fast opinion on where we should get our energy from. And then you have guys like Jeff from this article who realize this. And what do? You always hint that catastrophe is just right around the corner if we don't do something now. Okay, Jeff, what's that catastrophe? Well, I don't know, but I don't like it. And maybe I'm just becoming jaded to this at this point, but I'm getting tired, as I'm sure all of you are, of hearing this ambiguous, fearful rhetoric. But it works. Hopefully that serves as more inspiration for the rest of us to keep pushing back against it. I think we're slowly starting to see the tides of this turn. Whenever I see a video on YouTube or whatever that's talking about nuclear energy or just comments on articles like this, you will see there's always a couple people that say, thank God we needed to shut down Oyster Creek, blah, 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 get rid of it, whatever. But then overwhelmingly, there's a bunch of pro-nuclear activists that come in and start listing the statistics, start walking people through why they shouldn't be scared of it. And this is universal. I see this all over the place, and it could not be more promising. This is what needed to happen a long time ago, and thank God it finally is now. You just have to keep it up, even when something like this comes and kicks you in the jaw. Last article that I want to get to today comes to us from The Hill, titled U.S. Nuclear Power, Too Strategic to Fail, by David Gady, who's an opinion contributor and published this article on August 30th of 2018. The article starts off, the advances by China and Russia in nuclear power are daunting. Both countries are fully engaged in the construction of nuclear plants, loading fuel into reactors, connecting nuclear plants to the grid, developing programs for closing the fuel cycle, conducting research and development on advanced reactors, and, in order to sustain these cycles of activity, securing decades-long nuclear construction deals throughout the world. And that last line there, securing decade-long nuclear deals, is why I wanted to talk about this article. Because I don't think it's talked about enough from a geopolitical standpoint, and it should be a factor in America's energy policy. So the author makes the claim that the issue of nuclear power in the United States extends beyond the Vogtle Project. For those who are unaware, the Vogtle Project is our only current active new nuclear construction in the United States. The disparity that separates the United States from China and Russia is not the international order of nuclear science, engineering, and technology envisioned by Presidents Truman and Eisenhower and the early framers of U.S. nuclear policy. Moreover, this disparity in progress is a consequence of a disparity in strategy. He continues to say that the U.S. civilian nuclear sector is in a battle on multiple fronts to hold what ground it has in America's energy landscape. Domestically, it's battling a market that, as currently structured, cannot recognize or value nuclear energy for its zero-carbon baseload reliability or for its intrinsic national security attributes. It's also battling an energy policy ideology based on the U.S. meeting all energy and economic needs with 100% renewable energy. No need for fossil fuels or nuclear. So he goes on to talk about how China and Russia are using these nuclear plants, these state-owned corporations in these countries are using nuclear plants to help foster new geopolitical relations with developing countries. He talks about how China is particularly strategic with the Belt and Road Initiative, the centerpiece of its geopolitical strategy, where advancing cooperation in the development of nuclear power is incorporated into the Belt and Road Initiative vision. In his 2014 address to the 6th Ministerial Conference of the China Arab States Cooperation Forum, President Xi Jinping laid out China's 1+2+3 comprehensive cooperation strategy, explaining that 1 refers to energy cooperation, and 3 includes a cooperation around advanced nuclear technologies that President Xi identifies as one of the breakthrough levers in an effort to raise the level of pragmatic China-Arab cooperation. And here's really the crux of this article. He says, "It's challenging enough that China and Russia are advancing their civilian nuclear programs and expertise at a faster pace than that of the United States. What's more concerning is the extent to which nuclear power is being leveraged as a strategic technology with the overall geopolitical strategies of two authoritarian countries." Now, luckily, it seems to be that most nuclear writers that I come across are solution-oriented. And luckily, Mr. Gady had concluded with, "The issues at hand is not so much a question of whether nuclear projects in the United States are too big to fail. It's much larger and more systemic than that. The issue is that nuclear power in America is too strategic to fail, and two of the steps necessary to ensure that it doesn't fail are the completion of Vogtle and the development of a robust public-private partnership dedicated to developing advanced nuclear technologies and keeping the U.S. competitive on a global civilian nuclear stage." Now, I wanted to share this article with you as another arrow in your quiver for when you come across conversations, whether with family or friends, pertaining to, well, why should we keep this Vogtle plant running? Why do we care if we're the ones building this nuclear technology? I've heard China and Russia are doing a good job at that, and they are. And it's no secret that the environment stands to win whenever a nuclear plant is built anywhere. However, I would like to see the United States, being that I'm a citizen of it, maintain and help advance the technology that it pioneered. I also wanted to share it too because it's just another good argument for nuclear power and why we should be ramping it up here in the United States and around the world for that matter. I think that we are starting to become aware of this fact as an industry, and luckily we see new laws getting passed, seems like more often now, that are pro-nuclear and helping with our advanced nuclear industry. And while a little bit is good, we could always use more help. There's always room for improvement, so let's keep pushing for that. Up next, we have a fantastic interview with Mr. Bob Fine and Eric Lowen, and they're here to talk to us about navigating nuclear and how it's going to help educate the next generation of students on the merits of nuclear energy. Stay tuned. Today, I'm very excited to have on our two next guests, Bob Fine and Eric Lowen, both instrumental in implementing the Navigating Nuclear program, which directly touches on an issue that we've talked about before with other guests, and that is that we need to have an effective way to educate students on the merits of nuclear energy. And that's exactly what Navigating Nuclear aims to do. But before we get into the specifics of it, Bob, Eric, how about you tell us a little bit about yourself? Let's go ahead and start with you, Bob.
Okay, Doug. I've been the executive director of the American Nuclear Society for 6.5 years, and I've been in the association management business for almost 30 years. My educational background is actually in law. I went to law school, graduated law school, and then wound up working for a medical association in the government relations area. Eventually, I got increasingly involved in management, moved out of government relations, worked for a number of medical associations, and then came to ANS about 6.5 years ago.
Awesome. How about you, Eric?
I joined the American Nuclear Society over 20 years ago. And in that role, I was just an individual member. Later, when I went to graduate school, I took on leadership roles in the local sections. Then when I progressed in my employment in a lot of different sectors, I ended up at a national laboratory and took on increasing roles and became a member of the board of directors. When I left and took my current role here at General Electric as a chief engineer, I was asked by the society to step forward to become first the treasurer and then shortly thereafter to be the president of the society in 2011 and 2012. And as a longtime supporter of the American Nuclear Society, that's how I got involved in this discovery education process. So that gives you kind of my ANS background and why I'm here today.
Cool, cool. So obviously both of you are here to talk a little bit about Navigating Nuclear. So could you give us just kind of a high-level overview on what that program entails?
Sure, I'll start, Doug. Navigating Nuclear is an educational program of the American Nuclear Society. It's geared for students from kindergarten to 12th grade. And the program offers a curriculum as well as educational materials on nuclear science and technology. The focus of the program, Doug, is nuclear energy. And we're beginning with middle school students for the upcoming 2018-2019 school year, which actually just began. And the program was launched just a couple of weeks ago, August 15th.
So if I could add just a little bit, Doug, what you have is a group of ANS volunteers who are the society members, and we work with the staff, which is Bob and his staff, on this program, and we reach out to this entity called Discovery Education because of their expertise in this particular area of making curriculum. And we wanted to be involved in a kindergarten through grade 12 educational program. And Discovery reaches over 4 million teachers. They have 50 million students. So they had the right sort of thing that we could put what we think our program is into classrooms around the United States.
As I said in the intro, this is an issue very near and dear to the show here. We've talked with Mothers for Nuclear before about this, and Meredith Angwin and others saying that a crucial part in ensuring the next nuclear generation is educating kids while they're still in school on the merits of nuclear energy. So could you kind of go over some of the motivating factors that inspired ANS to implement this program?
Well, the main motivation really came from ANS members. As an association, we do a lot of surveys of members, and of course, I get to talk to members all the time who call me or who I meet at conferences. And the surveys, as well as the conversations I've had with members, indicated that they really wanted us to do a lot more public outreach, especially with students. So that was really the main motivator. As far as objectives of the program, first and foremost, it's to increase awareness of the safe, effective, and valuable applications of nuclear science and technology. And of course, to do this, we're providing teachers with a nuclear science curriculum and educational materials developed by nuclear experts. That's the most important aspect, that all of this was vetted by nuclear experts led by Eric.
And then if I could follow on to Bob, what we were really trying to do is clear up a lot of misconceptions. So being a parent of two kids and 11 foster kids, when I went into the classrooms or saw the textbooks, I thought they misrepresented nuclear power unfairly compared to other technologies because they'd have these random pictures of, let's say, Chernobyl or those sort of things. So we wanted, in this STEM education, we wanted to make those students who get them interested in science and then clear up some of these technical misconceptions about it. And then in the end, we want to show them the exciting careers that are involved in nuclear science and technology because they're not what they think. And Discovery has done a good job as far as helping us better portray the excitement that we have in this community.
You know, it's kind of funny because I remember going through grade school and remember that the main emphasis on nuclear energy, as you said, was unfair. And a lot of the focus on it had to deal with the accidents. And I kind of wonder if that's because they were thinking, well, if we talk about the bad stuff about it, the accidents, then maybe that'll keep students' heads from hitting the desk. But with that, then, I mean, what are some of the aspects of nuclear technology that you hope students get out of this? Because obviously, it's such a broad field. What do you want the takeaways to be topically?
Well, while the focus is on nuclear energy, the program also covers the application of nuclear science and technology in medicine and space exploration, and also covers molecular science. I think space exploration in particular is probably very stimulating for the students.
What they call STEM starters. So we provided some of those so that a teacher and or their class or students could get involved and, again, see the excitement there is in science.
I think when you ask kids why they like science, or the ones that do, they'll tell you that it's hands-on. And I think with a lot of experiments that you do in class, you get to, you know, pour the vinegar in the volcano and watch it erupt and all that sort of stuff. But obviously one of the barriers with nuclear technology is that it may be hard to get that hands-on experience. So what sort of tools will Navigating Nuclear offer to students and teachers so that they can kind of supplement that hands-on experience?
So the first thing that we're making available is these digital lesson plans on nuclear energy. So I think Discovery Education has done a good thing is kind of change the landscape in our schools. So we no longer have the textbooks that keep getting passed down from grade to grade to grade. You have this living document called their tech book. And so that's the first thing, that our digital lessons will be a part of this tech book that students have access to. Then we have the STEM project starters that we talked about. One is to look at fission, one's to look at fusion, one's to look at radiopharmaceuticals, and then the other one is nuclear energy, of how do we turn binding energy into the electrons going down the grid. Then we thought it was important so the students could see, so that we have profiles of three different type of American Nuclear Society members and three different types of fields, and they get a feel of, you know, what it's like to be a professor, what it's like to be a fuel engineer, and what it's like to work in the medical industry. And then what's kind of interesting using Discovery Education's approach is they call it a virtual field trip. So when Bob and I were in school, I don't know how old you are, Doug, you know, it was a big deal to get the permission slip and get on the bus and go to someplace. So to do some of these field trips that they do with Discovery Education to go see sharks in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, what they're trying to do is get that look and feel of a field trip. And we worked with Palo Verde Generation Station to get behind the scenes. And so the students will be able to see that in October. And then the last thing is the resource available. This is on a website. This website's available to any teacher, any school that has access to the internet. So there's Discovery Education has paid subscribers, which have access to this. And also the way we put it forth is we're making it available to anybody. So that's the last resource, if you will, is this website.
Well, and that's got to be one of the great advantages with Discovery Education and the fact that technology has advanced as far as it has, because it really can bring these sorts of things, like you said, the shark in the middle of the Pacific, this virtual field trip to Palo Verde, into the classroom. So could you kind of tell us a little bit more about this virtual field trip?
Yeah, so Palo Verde is the biggest generation site in the United States because they have three pressurized water reactors side by side that generate electricity for Phoenix and California and a few other places. So it's a pretty big place. And we picked it. You know, there's 99 nuclear power plants, but kind of put our heads together and, you know, what would be the best for the kids. So what they're going to see is how a nuclear power plant works in taking this thing called binding energy and how it turns that into heat, and then how it makes steam, how it turns a turbine. They're going to see how the heat is rejected into the environment using reclaimed water, which to get the kids' attention, we call it toilet water. And we'll open up, hope this is not a spoiler alert, but we'll have a scene of flushing a toilet, which will probably get some middle school students engaged right off the bat. And then we talk about used fuel, and we're doing that based on questions that we got in anticipation of doing this with different students. And then one particular scene, we actually have students that are in middle school interacting with Geiger counters, and ANS is working on putting some kits together that teachers could then purchase those, and they could bring those sort of resources in their classroom if they wanted to.
Eric, I tell you what, that sounds like a field trip that I'd want to go on personally. And with that, I want to help the Navigating Nuclear program, and I think a lot of ANS members and a lot of listeners to this show would also like to do, because we want to see this be as successful as it can. Are there any avenues in which those listening who are interested can help out with the program?
It's real easy. All they got to do is give to their school teacher of their choice, their favorite school teacher, our web site, Navigating Nuclear, and all of the resources that I talked about are available. Any teacher or homeschooler or anybody else has access to use those. And then that also gives link back to the American Nuclear Society's portfolio of different digital information that we have in our refereed journals, in our news articles, reports at our different meetings. So it just opens the door up to all the science that we do as a technical society.
So are there any expansion plans for this program? Because as you said, right now it's just listed in the middle school realm. Are there any plans to take it beyond that?
If ANS gets the funding, and this is all being supported by philanthropic dollars, we'll be rolling out curricula and educational materials for high schools and elementary schools. Our hope is over the next couple of years. But again, that's all dependent on whether or not we get the funding.
Yeah, well, that seems to be the case with just about everything. So now that we're kind of winding down with the questions here, is there anything else that you'd like the audience to know about navigating nuclear?
Navigating nuclear, from our point of view and this ANS's point of view, it's an exciting program. We're all very proud to be offering it, and our leadership and a lot of our members who are already who already know about the program are very supportive. What we want to do, of course, and that's part of the reason we're talking to you today, Doug, is we want to get the word out. We want everybody in the nuclear field, including the listeners, of course, to learn more about the program and then help us promote it, as Eric was just talking about, promote it to their favorite local teachers, local schools, and especially the schools that aren't currently using Discovery Education materials. So any listener that's interested in helping to promote the program is welcome to contact me. Let me give you my email address, and I'd love to hear from folks. My email address is rfine, that's F-I-N-E, rfine, at ans.org. All they have to do is email me for information on how they can help, and we'd love to get them involved.
All right. Well, thank you, Bob. And everyone, I'll be sure to put that email address in the description below. Eric, how about you? Any closing thoughts?
Yes, this is where I'm excited. So during my career at ANS, I've been involved in a lot of different surveys with our membership. And one of the resounding things, it's been a continuous sort of thing that I have heard for the last 15 years being in different leadership roles within ANS, is we have to do more as far as outreach. How do we get rid of those misconceptions? And this was a kind of a top tier objective of ANS. We have different things that we've done as far as teachers workshops and Boy and Girl Scout merit badges and different sort of things like that. But this gives us national reach, if you will, because we're working with Discovery Education, who's top in their class, and we're coming with curriculum that's been vetted by our society. And those two synergies, if you will, I think are going to make something that's going to be of value in our classrooms and to our other ANS volunteers that want to use this to help people understand nuclear science and technology.
That certainly is true. It's always exciting to see an action item go into, well, action. Well, Bob, Eric, thank you very much for coming on the program. Everyone else, stick around. We will wrap up the show momentarily. It does feel nice to get back in the saddle here and making these again. I tell you what, it's been too long. That's why the news segment might have been a little more fired up than I normally would. But that's what happens after 3 months of me not being able to vent and talk to myself. So thank you for those who listen to me talk to myself. And also, big thank you to Bob and Eric taking time out of their busy day to come and talk to us about this wonderful program. I hope everyone else is excited about it as I am, because as we've said, maybe for the third time now, that this is something that needed to happen and we're doing it. And I think the overall trend with this nuclear industry is that we are better identifying the things that we need to do and then actually doing them. It's one thing to point out the problems, but unless you have actions to fix these problems, they're always going to be problems, right? Nothing changes if nothing changes. And luckily, there's changes starting to roll down the pipeline now that are making a positive impact on the nuclear community. If we keep working for those goals and working towards fixing those solutions, I have no doubt that the future is very bright indeed. So with that being said, I think that will bring this week's episode to a close. I hope you enjoyed. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Radio Nuclear and head over to the website www.radionuclear.org and sign up for our mailing list. There'll be some big news coming out soon. That's all I'm going to say on that. Regardless, take care, and I hope you have a good one. I'm Doug Hartmeier, signing off.